It's Philosophy Talk.
In love with one woman, 49 years. My wife finds out, she'd kill me.
What is a wife?
I should have known something was wrong with my first wife. When I brought her home to meet my parents, they approved of her, you know, but...
Is the concept of a wife an outmoded relic of our chauvinistic past?
Would you mind lending me your wife?
Sure, you'll be a sham wife, but you'll be the envy of every other sham wife in town.
I hope that someday my wife will learn to live on her allowance, which is ample.
What's wrong with taking care of a woman? She takes care of you.
I think it's hard to get away from old roles.
Our guest is Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife.
In the words of a woman around 1810, I wouldn't give my hand without my heart.
From now on, I'm only marrying for love, and possibly once more for money.
Recorded in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
What is a wife? Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're recording the program in front of a live audience at the Marsh Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Today we ask, what is a wife?
Ken, what kind of half-baked sexist question is that? Why do you want to focus just on wives? How about husbands? And what about same-sex marriages? Why not be gender neutral and politically correct? Why not ask, what is a spouse?
Well, besides the fact that that doesn't have the same ring, there's also the fact that neither the category husband nor the category spouse in general is as historically, culturally, or philosophically interesting as the category wife. I mean, in one form or another, marriage has been around for thousands of years. But until very recently, I mean, what was there really to say about husbands? I mean, you could sum it up in a few sentences. Husbands were the dominant partners in marriage, the masters, the breadwinners, the ones who could own property, including their own wives.
So somehow wives, the concept of wife, is more interesting? Tell me how.
Well, there's all manner of things to say about wives. I mean, they used to be little more than property. Material property and sexual property. I mean, in some cultures, wives were confined to the home, had little choice as to whom they would marry, could even be legally put to death for cheating on their husbands.
That doesn't sound much like contemporary wives. A contemporary wife is her husband's equal, sexually, financially, educationally. A growing number are better educated, earn more money, and work longer hours. That's a real plus. Longer hours outside the home than their husbands.
Well, precisely, John. See how much wifehood has changed over the years? But you know, you make a contemporary wife sound just a little bit like the husband of old. Is that where we've come to?
Oh, yeah. Modern wives don't dominate their husbands like the husbands of old used to dominate their wives. It's just that the needs and desires of the contemporary wife play a big role, as big a role as the needs and desires of the contemporary husband in deciding the fundamental matters in the family. Isn't that way in your family?
Well, that may be the ideal, but I don't think the facts on the ground always live up to that ideal, John.
Well, that's probably right. But just the fact that the ideal of marriage has evolved, even if the actuality isn't keeping up with it, that's progress. Marriage used to be explicitly conceived as a theater of inequality between men and women. Being a wife was a way of being oppressed. The oppression was often dressed up with poetry and roses and romance, and it was justified by philosophical and theological doctrines. But still, it was oppression. It was oppression all the same.
You know, for many women in many cultures, including certain subcultures right here in the good old USA, I'm afraid to say, marriage still functions as a theater of inequality and oppression. And, you know, there are people of both genders who think that's the way it ought to be and stay.
Well, I'm afraid you're right about that. But I think you've convinced me we can get a lot of insight by thinking about wives, but using the concept of a wife to think about husbands and also larger social trends. We can do that by focusing on exactly what a wife is and should be.
Right, and that's our goal, to use the very idea of a wife as a kind of window into the larger social world.
Still, what about same-sex marriage? That puzzles me a bit. when two people of the same gender get married, does it still make sense to think of a relationship between a husband and wife? Can there be two wives, two husbands? How do you think about that?
Well, John, your question presupposes that husband and wife have to be tied to gender and sex roles. Maybe that's the way it used to be, but maybe we're entering a brave new world in which roles in marriage are cut entirely free from the traditional sex and gender roles. Maybe we can have male wives and female husbands and no wife. I mean, anything's possible now.
Well, Ken, you seem to know a lot about all this, but I hope there's somebody around that knows even more.
Well, you know what? We're fortunate, because there's somebody around. We've got a guest who knows more than both of us combined. That's Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife. She'll join us in a little bit.
And we really want our live audience here at the Marsh to join in the conversation, too.
But first, our roving philosophical reporter, Andy McDaniel, introduces us to someone who has taken a very proactive approach to her own young marriage. She files this report.
I did and do now consider myself very happily married.
Elizabeth Weil has always been a bit of an overachiever. She's a successful writer, an involved parent, and just a thoughtful person in general. But until recently, her marriage wasn't something she put much effort into.
I had a very passive view about marriage, that either our marriage was going to be star-crossed and we were going to be blissfully happy, or we weren't, and there wasn't a thing I could do about it. And I realized that was so unlike me. So I decided to take a proactive approach and sort of see, well, what would happen if we actually worked on it?
Wilde decided to make a project of improving her already happy marriage. She chronicled the experience in the New York Times Magazine in 2009. Step one was research.
We decided to start sort of in the self-help vein. It seemed sort of safest to, like, be at home. So we bought tons of books in one day. It was actually harder to start than I anticipated. But eventually we just, I picked a book and I said to Dan, pick an exercise. They're filled with these exercises.
Weil's proactive approach to shaping her marriage would have seemed really unusual just a few decades ago. According to Devira Cohn, a senior writer at the Pew Research Center and co-author of a recent report on marriage, the roles and responsibilities of husband and wife weren't always so negotiable.
When people are asked, what's the more satisfying marriage, the ones where you have the traditional roles where the husband works and the wife takes care of children and the home, and compared with the shared roles where both partners do a little of everything, most people now agree that the more satisfying marriage is the one where roles are shared.
But that doesn't mean there aren't consequences in a situation where everything is up for grabs. In her article about her marriage experiment, Elizabeth Weil says in some ways figuring out parenting roles is easier than figuring out marriage roles.
The children do not get to vote on the direction of the relationship on which sleep training they like best. But with a spouse, particularly a contemporary American spouse, equality is foundational, assumed. And this is, of course, in my life, completely true. And I don't want to be in a democracy with my children. They're 4 and 7. That would be horrible.
Meanwhile, the democracy that is marriage can be rather unwieldy.
Dan is also a journalist. We both work at home. We are like the parody is extreme. The daily figuring out who should be doing what and right down to like, well, do you get to go to the gym now or do I get to go to the gym now? Do you get the good office in our home? There are two home offices, or do I get the good home office? Like, that is exhausting.
So if marriage no longer provides a structure to help men and women negotiate their adult lives, then what exactly is it for? In her recent survey, Devira Cohn of the Pew Center discovered that for men, marriage now holds one promise that it never used to.
The gains from marriage have been larger for men over the last 4 decades, and that's in large part because more of their wives are likely to be working. The man who got married in 1970 did not likely marry a working wife, but in 2007, he does.
For other women, or at least for Elizabeth Weil, the gains from marriage are more ethereal.
There's something vestigial about it in a way. I'm not sure what would be different if I were not married. That said, it's deeply meaningful to me. The tradition of it is meaningful to me, even though I feel like we have a very contemporary marriage and we've shaped our marriage as our own.
As for Weil's project of becoming more excellently married, it turned out okay. She's detailing the rest of her experience in her upcoming book about marriage, No Cheating, No Dying.
Those actually were our private vows, so far so good.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Andy McDaniel.
I'm John Perry, along with Ken Taylor, and you're listening to Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
And we're joined now by Marilyn Yalom. She's author of A History of the Wife, a book highly pertinent to our current subject, and her most recent book is The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds. Marilyn, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Glad to be here.
Marilyn, you've written a succession of books with wonderful titles and great reviews, but the one we want to talk about is A History of the Wife. Now, why A History of the Wife? Why not A History of Marriage or A History of the Spouse?
I had written a book called A History of the Breast before that, and you might say that I've gone from the part to the whole. But I think the real reason was that it was something I knew about personally, and I limited it to American history and Western history. I couldn't take on the whole world. Mm-hmm. And I thought also that it was a pertinent subject to what was going on in the world, in particularly our world today, that the wife, the word itself, is already something of a controversial word.
We're gonna look at things historical, but let's start out with the present. And the whole world's too depressing, but America and the West. To what extent has the ideal of marriage as a theater of equality rather than inequality between men and women taken hold?
I think that it has taken hold as an ideal. I think that it has even changed for the better, and I would say that equality in marriage does represent a change for the better. And we are far from a 50-50 division of equality in marriage, but we're getting there.
I think we are getting there, especially in sort of upper middle class place America, maybe middle class America. But I mean, how deep do you think that is? I mean, there's still a subculture in this country, take religious fundamentalists and stuff, who think a woman's place is in the home, a man should be dominant. I mean, there's still a lot of resistance to that idea, at least in the U.S. I don't know about the Western world.
I think there's resistance, but if you look at the past 2,500 years, as I do in my book, A History of the Wife, there's been enormous change. It has sped up so much since World War II that equality is something we can talk about without being embarrassed. And I do think that even things that we looked at with surprise 10 years ago, say men carrying babies in frontal packs, we don't bat an eyelash when we see a man in that situation today. So the change is happening.
I think you're right, and we'll have to dig into more about the details of that change and what's driving it. I think you're right that the change is happening. But this is a special edition of Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Marsh Theater in San Francisco. We're asking, what is a wife? With Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife.
We've been talking just a little bit about how the notion of wives varies from culture to culture and group to group within America. In our next segment, we'll take a closer look at how the idea of a wife has changed over time, and we'll examine what reasons a woman could possibly have in this day and age for wanting to become a wife.
Why become a wife? Then and now, along with questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
This I tell you, brother, you can't have one without the other. Love and marriage, love and marriage.
Welcome back to the Marsh Theater and to Philosophy Talk. The question we're asking is, what is a wife? I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife.
We'd like our audience to join the discussion by stepping up to one of the microphones at either end of the stage, either side of the stage. How have our conceptions of marriage and wifehood changed over the centuries? Why did anybody want to become a wife in the bad old days when women were little more than sexual property and were excluded from the public sphere? And why does anyone want to be a wife now? when there are so many other opportunities open to women?
So, Marilyn, let's start where John just left off. I think those are great questions. I want you to help us get into the heads of women in different times and cultures. Help us think about how women's perspective on the question whether to wed or not to wed has changed as a function of women's changing social situation.
Well, it certainly has changed. We see more and more households that are headed by single women and single mothers. And we also see women and men marrying later. Within the last 50 years, the age of marriage for a wife has moved up from 20 to 25. And some people defer marriage so long that they never marry. We also have so many people who are cohabiting rather than marrying. And you ask the question, why would anyone want to marry in the first place? Certainly the issue of children enters in, which was originally the major reason that people got married in the first place. People today often marry when a baby's on the way or when they want to have a baby. So the issue of children can't be divorced.
So is that the big constant? I mean, the wed or not wed question, if I'm a woman in ancient Greece, and if I'm going to be wed, I'm going to be, I guess, my husband's property. I'm going to be confined to the house, right? I'm thinking, to wed or not to wed? That doesn't sound too good unless I look at the alternatives, I guess.
Well, that woman in ancient Greece didn't have any choice. She was gifted by her father to a prospective husband. And sometimes she wasn't even at the ceremony when that gift was made. So changes have been gradual over time. Roman women had more rights than Greek women. And way into the 18th century, 19th century, women were in this country still considered femme couvert. That is, they were under the jurisdiction of their husbands. But things began to change even within the last 200 years.
So just to jump ahead, I mean, I am a man. I suppose I have a man's perspective, but I'm a philosopher, so I can rise above that. And when I rise above that and look down on it, it looks to me like men are a tremendous problem. I mean, they have these characteristics that were no doubt useful in evolution, like being aggressive and so forth. But, you know, they mostly populate the prisons. They're responsible for most of the violence. They're difficult to educate. They're really not necessary or soon won't be for procreation. Is there really any motivation for a modern woman to marry a man?
There's still sex that most women enjoy with men, although there are many women who enjoy sex with women. I think that is certainly a consideration. If you fall in love with someone, that will not be enough to keep you married for a half century, as I have been. But it's a good beginning. And since about 1800 in this country, women have believed that they don't want to give, in the words of a woman around 1810, I wouldn't give my hand without my heart. So the idea of loving the other person, who usually is a man when it's a matter of a woman in love.
There's something striking. I don't know if I have the details right from your book. You start one of the chapters with a woman who doesn't want to marry this guy who would be a great provider, a great father. Mm-hmm. It's suggested by her family. I can't remember the details exactly. Mm-hmm. But she's writing about how she doesn't want to marry him because she doesn't love him. Right? All these advantages to marrying this guy, all these social advantages, economic advantages. But that was like a peculiar moment in history when that started to happen, right?
It was a peculiar moment in history because women didn't usually have much choice about who they married. They married because their parents chose for them, or they married along the considerations of property. If you were a peasant woman on a piece of property next to another peasant's family, your families would get together because they thought that those pieces of land should go together.
Do you have a deep view about what drove these kind of change? I mean, was it a what the, you know, I mean, at some point people stopped thinking the king was sovereign and there was all this social turmoil. When did women start to claim ownership, more ownership of themselves, more autonomy for them? What part of, was it the Enlightenment? Was it the, when did this happen and why?
I am of the school that believes that in Anglo-American history, in Anglo history, it begins about the time of Shakespeare. And what goes on in those plays with younger people, Romeo and Juliet, confronting parental authority, is played out throughout that society. The Protestant Reformation made a difference, too. We move from a society, medieval, where virginity, abstinence were preferred to even marriage, sexuality and marriage. And with the Reformation, with Luther marrying, you get the model in Protestant countries of the pastoral couple. And you begin to see at that moment some beginnings of the idea of equality in marriage.
Now, I'm no historian of philosophy, but the first figure I remember that really is very explicit about the rights and role of women is Mary Wollstonecraft, who you mentioned discussed in your book. Mm-hmm. Did she come out of nowhere? This was in, 1700s?
1790s, yes.
Yeah. Did she come out of nowhere, or was there
some
background?
Well, she had some pretty radical parents to begin with, but the 18th century was certainly a moment in Europe when there was a push for, a limited push for women to have some authority in their families. There were a lot of other things going on as well, and women did take a setback both in this country and, say, in France, which are the two civilizations I know the best. But after all, you did have Abigail Adams writing to her husband that all men would be tyrants if you would let them, and that one should write into law something to defend wives.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about what is a wife at the Mars Theater with Marilyn Yalom, who's author of A History of the Wife. And we'd love to have questions from our live studio audience. We've got one on this side of the room now. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, I'm Amy Whalen from San Francisco. My question is, can women make progress on their own? And historically, has that been true? It strikes me, seeing my friends, that when the men in the relationships don't take things like parenting leave, that hurts women ultimately. So historically, have women made progress on their own, or do they depend on men as well?
I'd like to answer that with in two parts. You spoke about women and children, parenting. I am of the belief that today the real distinction in this society is not so much between men and women as it is between men, women, and mothers. If you look at the earning power of women today who are single, their earning power is very, single and motherless, excuse me, their earning power is almost that of men. But if you look at the earning power of mothers, their earning power is still at that 75% level. So there's a real problem, I believe, a bigger problem for mothers than for anyone else in society. It's not just a gender distinction. Your second part of the question is, can women on their own make a difference? Yes, I do believe that. I think the women's movement of the 60s and 70s made a difference. And we're living with the ramifications
movement. I understand what you're saying. And surely, in some sense, women's demands and claims of self-governance and self-ownership is the vanguard of social change. But unless somehow they bring along men as cooperating partners in social change, then there's just sort of further war between the sexes, as it were. Right? There's no kind of equilibrium in social change where men and women say, yeah, this is better for all of us together. I mean, so men have to come along.
Absolutely. I have no doubt about that. But women will lead the way.
Oh, definitely. I mean, because they've got to be the vanguard. We've got another question from this side of the auditorium. Welcome to Philosophy Talk. Tell us your name and where you're from. And
okay, thank you. My name is Voke. I'm a grad student from Palo Alto. I'm Nigerian. And in my culture, being married confers some social advantages, like besides the obvious advantage of being called Mrs. and being in some societies that are just for married people. Women also get more respect when they're perceived as being married. So in the American society today, is there any social advantage that other women of same age do not get, that the married ones get?
Excellent question. And one of the arguments for gay marriage is that, you know, we shouldn't give to married heterosexual couples these advantages, whatever they supposedly are, and exclude the...
But I don't know what the advantages are. I mean, in Europe, there's a widespread feeling that it's a disadvantage to get married. Most of the young people I know that live there don't get married. What about America?
What's your take on this question?
It's a difficult question. The old days, we would say there were many, many advantages to being a wife. People felt that you fulfilled your natural destiny. And people wore the words Mrs. like a badge of honor. I think that changed. You get the expression, I'm just a housewife. Mm-hmm. And so I think that being just a housewife has been something that's been downgraded. But more and more women are out there in the workplace, and that is what confers dignity and self-respect to many, many women. Now, I don't want to deny the fact that there are about 10% of married women who never work, and that's sometimes for ideological reasons, but more often it's because they have a husband who's a female partner who's a sufficient bread earner. But most women today are working, and so they are at the same time wives and workers. And I think that in this country is what is raising the self-esteem of women.
If you do a sort of cost-benefit analysis of marriage in terms of like social and economic cost-benefit analysis, apparently it used to be that marriage was a greater boon to women than it was to men in terms of their economic status and social well-being and all that sort of stuff. Apparently that equation has shifted radically in favor of marriage being more important to men for their overall well-being, their economic... Apparently women between the ages of 30 and 44, that's the first generation in history who are better educated than their husbands or who make on average... Well, I don't know if they all make on more, but they have much more equality, educational... economic equality, and actually they have more education than their husbands. And I guess in 1970, 4% of women used to make more than their husbands. Now it's like 22%, mm-hmm. and the same thing with more education. So it's like the cost-benefit analysis is shifting toward it's more advantageous to men to get married economically than it was to women. What's all of the
social science studies seem to indicate that men do better when they are married, and that single women do better than married women.
So your analysis is men and women on one side, mothers on the other side. That seems quite compelling to me, and it raises, you know, social issues. I mean, insofar as children are necessary to the thriving state, mothers are definitely necessary to the thriving state. What's the motivation to be a mother? What could we do about this? Is child care going to help? Should we just pay people for being mothers? Or what are the social structures you see as somehow would be a way of repairing this?
Well, I think that Europe has done a much better job than we have in providing services for mothers. And it's interesting that in the countries that have the best plans, that is for creche, for daycare, for after-school care, the birth rate is not going down in France, for example. But if you compare that to Germany, where their schools ended at 1 o'clock, you had to have a mother at home for that child, the birth rate is something like 1.3 per couple.
I'm trying to get one question in before the break. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. My name is Sandra O'Neill, and I'm a registered nurse forever, and I live in Palo Alto. I'm puzzled because a big piece of this picture and these questions are missing the whole biological reproductive drive that Mother Nature gives us. And the thing that's made recent choices possible for women is contraception. And we don't want to forget that in our culture. But I was a wife when I had a child till he was about 8, and it worked out fine that way. And I'm very excited about all the changes and the kind of things you've contributed. But I'm really pleased about the part about the mother, because I think society's designed to protect mothers with children, and we got to do it some way. So I'm curious about more information about where the biological part fits in.
Does seem to be a strong drive in many people, men as well as women. And it is a question that we're going to have to deal with as a society, because more and more women are having babies without partners. 40% of babies in this country are born out of wedlock. And we do very little to provide for single mothers. We do very little to provide for mothers. And I think it is something that society is going to have to address sooner or later.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance. We're asking, what is a wife, with Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife.
In our next segment, we're going to ask where marriage is headed. With the rise of single-sex marriage, with a growing economic and social status of women, is the very idea of a wife as distinct from a partner or a spouse or a significant other just outmoded?
Wither the wife. Plus more questions from our live audience when Philosophy Talk continues.
Welcome back to the program. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're asking, what is a wife, with Marilyn Yalom, author of A History of the Wife. And we got questions from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, I'm Sol from San Francisco. I was just curious about whether the term wife is necessarily gender specific, if it's always associated with women. That seems to be mainly what we've been talking about, but I feel like there's more that's encompassed in that term.
Well, that's an interesting question. In a way, that the term wife is getting pulled in two directions. Insofar as you're a woman who's married and therefore a wife, you don't want it to really be tied to the traditional role of being at home, not being the breadwinner, and being mainly in charge of the children. Insofar as you want the concept of wife to apply in a same-sex marriage, though, you probably have in mind applying it to the person who plays those traditional roles. So just from a point of view of philosopher language, it's fascinating development.
Right.
Marilyn probably has something to say.
Wife names a role, has traditionally named a role, but it also names the occupant of a certain role, who traditionally has been the female partner in this thing. And John's saying maybe these two things are being pulled apart.
Well, I think that's true. I think that wife as a legal and religious term will probably continue. As far as the role of the wife is concerned, that doesn't have to be gender specific. And if we mean by being the wife the person who is the supporting member of a family, who has all of those attributes that we associate with being a helpmeet to one's spouse, that can be extended to people of either gender.
We used to have phrases like who wears the pants in the family, but that's a dead metaphor now because everybody in the family wears pants.
But but you know, so look, I mean, so let's project forward. So we there's this social revolution that's been going on for a long time. I don't know if we're at the tail end of it, in the middle, or what, but and you think of it's still continuing. Think of gay marriage and the growing lack acceptance of that. I don't say it's fully accepted in America, but there seems to me to be a growing acceptance and a dying resistance. And women, we were talking about how the around the industrialized world, women are starting to outstrip men in educational achievement. Around the industrialized, more women graduating from college, doing better in college than men. I mean, elite colleges in the United States some of them, to make their entering classes 50-50, have to do kind of affirmative action for men, right? I mean, so can anything like this traditional conception, I mean, can anything like it even survive? I mean, isn't the whole thing just being radically reconfigured and all the old terms are just going to be jettisoned?
I don't think all the old terms will be jettisoned. Language is very conservative. And one of the things that you point out is that women are doing better than men in education. They're not doing better than them in jobs. They're certainly not represented fully in government. We're a long way from equality in influential positions.
I agree. That's true. And I think you put your finger on a big reason for that. It's because of the burdens of motherhood. Right, because a woman rising up in a career says, oh, I want to have children, become a mother, and we still have these structures, at least in the U.S., that motherhood costs you a lot in terms of economic and social opportunity. It costs you a lot.
There is that, but there's also, in a democracy, there's a big marginal effect of reactionary views because, like if you're Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, there we had reactionary views affecting them both. But basically, if only 6 or 5% of the electorate feel that somehow women shouldn't hold office, that makes it tremendously hard to get
office.
That's
true, because you think starting at a 6% deficit.
Yeah.
Right. We got another question in this side of the room. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, man.
Hi, my name is Lydia, and I'm from the Bay Area as well. And my question is kind of related to modern relationships, modern husband-wife relationships, where they choose not to have children, but the wife somehow ends up being more of like a housewife who also does work for the husband, who maybe has his own business and stuff like that. So is that like a new, more modern form of servitude?
It sounds like you think it is.
how about yes is possible?
Marilyn, what do you think?
I think it's hard to get away from old roles. And we're talking about roles and the things that are expected of women. But that's very fluid, very, very fluid. A lot of it has to do with who has the greater earning power in the family. We said earlier that 22% of marriages now have wives who earn more than their husbands. As that rises, women will be in greater positions of authority within marriage as well as outside of marriage.
See, I actually think there's a huge social thing, especially in America, less so in Europe, because Europe doesn't have quite the same problem that we do. We lock up a huge portion of our underclass males, mm-hmm. a huge portion. And one of the things about single mothers, that's all over economic strata, but it's complicated. It's concentrated more at the lower economic strata. And many of the men are out of the system. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think this is a huge social problem that we pay almost no attention to.
Right? It's a huge social problem. I agree with you completely. And I think it is an even greater problem in the black community, where you have more women having children out of wedlock than having children in wedlock. And you're having a society that very often has no male figures in the family. As you say, many of them are locked up, and many of them don't have the same educational level as the women.
Yes, definitely.
And so that's a magnification of a problem that we are having in this country. And are we addressing it?
God, no. No, God, not at all. We've got a male perspective over here, but a lot of our questions have been women. So this is, I think you're our second guy today.
Yes, this is Paul Carlstrom. I'm from San Francisco. In your book, you talk about, there's romance. We were talking about the early romance and love not being enough by themselves to make this work, especially when equality is involved. And I haven't heard you use this word that I think is very important in your book, and that's companionate marriage. Mm-hmm. It's a concept that is like a shared project, I guess. Could you speak about that?
Yes, I'm glad you brought that up. I do think that marriage as a partnership is perhaps the most important aspect of what keeps a marriage going. If you think that your husband's success is your success, if he thinks that your success is his success, then you're in it together as a team. And if you are able to take that team in the raising of children and in being a community member, I think your marriage has a much, much greater chance of surviving. That means you've got to have common values, common interests, and commitment.
But don't you think, I worry that, so I've been married for 27 years, so, you know, I've been at this for a long time. But I do worry that when you have two people both having high-powered careers, both really focused on their life outside the home, that, you know, each of them has their projects, and each of them supports the other projects, mm-hmm. but those projects can drive you apart as well as bring you together, right? Because you're rising up this ladder, she's rising up that ladder. And I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I'm of the belief that the commitment between a husband and wife should take precedence over everything else. And when I say that, I'm thinking of anything including jobs, including outside men or women who come into the marriage, and children. I do believe that commitment is something you have to keep coming back to. It's what Sartre and de Beauvoir called the essential commitment. And everything else was a contingent commitment.
Let me just follow up on that and pick up a thread from our first segment. In America, there has been this flight away from arranged marriages, and everybody mm-hmm. thinks that the American way is romance and love, and that's great. But in the Silicon Valley, actually, there's been quite a bit of interest in the fact that with a lot of Asians, and mm-hmm. particularly Asians from the Indian subcontinent, there are a lot of arranged marriages, and then people have studied statistically how they do, and they do very well. Is the arranged marriage really such a bad idea?
Well, now that I'm the mother of children who have been married, I don't think it's such a bad idea.
You say that as a mother, not as a scientist?
Yeah. As a scientist, I would say that semi-arranged marriages work just fine. Studies of Indians' marriages have shown that when the parents and the community get together to put two people together, and they have a chance to meet, and they have a chance to either say yes or no, that this can produce very happy marriages. And if we had marriage arrangers in this country, it probably would save people a lot of trouble, all of those who are on the internet or meeting at bars. Some of them, I think, would not at all be unhappy to have prospective spouses paraded before them.
Yentas.
We can take, you want a brief follow-up there?
The fact that one in two marriages roughly will end in divorce certainly has to influence the way people think about marriage. And it is a problem not just for the couple themselves, but for those surrounding them, the members of society, and something that we have talked an awful lot about, but we have come up with really no answers to divorce.
Marilyn, on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a really fun conversation.
Thank you very much.
Our guest has been Marilyn Yalom. She's author of A History of the Wife. Most recently, she's written a book called The American Resting Place, 400 Years of History Through Our Cemeteries and Burial Grounds.
We also want to thank everyone in our live audience for participating in the program, and I think you should give yourselves a big round of applause.
So, John, what are you thinking now? You've never been a wife, but you've had a wife for a long time. So
that's true. It seems like just a couple days, but it's been 48 years. Of course, we were a forced marriage at age 10. That's the reason. But it worked out well. What's my thinking? My thinking is there's two roles that need to be played in any family by the adults. One is the breadwinner, and one is the caregiver nurturer. And traditionally, those went with husband and wife. It didn't work out all that well. I mean, if you look at human history, it's mostly a disaster. but But they both need to, and people should just be counseled. Now, if you're going to get married, you have to figure out who's going to play these roles, and they can be shared.
Yeah.
But they can't, either one of them can't be ignored. So that's my final thought. Get rid of husband, get rid of wife. Let's have breadwinner, nurturer, and no sexual presuppositions. And everybody who wants a marriage license has to have a little diagram about how they're going to do that.
But you got to invest those with equal dignity and equal liberty and equal opportunity of all kinds, I think, because breadwinning puts you out in the world, puts you out. And one of the things I think is happening, I think marriage is, the institution of marriage is under great pressure because the economic incentives and the sort of incentives of the heart used to match up more. But I think the incentives of the heart are one thing, and the economic incentives are something entirely different and being radically restructured. And I don't think we know exactly how to put the heart and the economy back together.
And even bread turns out not to be that healthy. I mean, how
for the
gluten-free families, I don't know how my system would work.
This conversation continues, as always, on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And we have this growing Facebook page. We invite all of you to become fans. It's a lively space, so join up and check it out.
And you can also download podcasts of our program from our website. For the final word, we're going to turn to the very nurturing and long-suffering Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, those scanning the grim horizon of today's world for the more traditional role of a wife need look no further than the Quiverful movement. From Psalm 127, which says, regarding children, happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. The movement was sparked by the 1985 publication of The Way Home, Beyond Feminism, Back to Reality. Author Mary Pry charted her journey from feminism to evangelical Christianity and happiness in a biblically ordained role of mother, childbearer, and homeworker under a husband's authority. She's a proud helpmeet. Though not actual quiverfuls, the most conspicuous role models in the trend are the Duggars, stars of 18 Kids and Counting on Discovery, soon to be 19 Kids and Counting, the last born 3 months premature through emergency C-section. One blogging quiverful mom boasts of having 21 children. She can barely fit a picture of them on her homepage. I'm not a woman, but my womb hurts just thinking about it. There are scores of quiverful-ish blogs out there, most of them strangely written by women. Even mention of dads is rare, though one blogger lovingly refers to her husband as the captain. It is a strange, chirpy world on display. Homeschooling tips, crafts and tea, knitting, easy-bake oven marshmallow shooters, taco soup recipes, quilts, make-your-own ornaments, homemade gift tags and baskets, doilies, wreaths, and never-ending housework, of course. Broom, wipes, and vacuum cleaners are transformed by these moms into weapons in an ideological war. My mother used to call these battles chores. For the gals, modesty is generally a plus. Pictures show shoulder-to-floor dresses, kind of a Jane Austen meets Anne of Green Gables meets Pollyanna deal. But there's a dark underside to these blogs. Septic tanks go south. Washers break. 6 kids come down with chickenpox at the same time. Cars die, not to mention the creeping socialists and family planners barking at the door. There's no money. I counted 3 blogs in which the husband was out of work. Many pleas to pray for us. One woman with 8 children and 2 more who died advises how to put the Lord back into mommydom, her words. Place Bibles in several spots around your house so anytime you do get to sit down, you can snatch a verse or two to ponder. Another, describing what sounded like a normal, fussy 2-year-old to me, wrote, quote, my son has faced attacks from Satan and his evil demons since he was born, unquote. Then there's Andrea Yates, persuaded by her husband to stop taking antidepressant meds to conceive a 5th child. In 2001, she drowned them all and is now in a Texas state mental health facility. On the plus side, supposedly, there's Lady Lydia, role model for many quiverfullers, who blogged, quote, I'm sure you've been watching scenes from Katrina victims. I kept hoping I would see some lady fleeing the hurricane in clothes which looked presentable. Instead, the image I was presented were almost uniformly an ugly T-shirt combined with these big shorts. Can you imagine having only those clothes on your back and nothing else? When will the women of our country wake up? No wonder marriages are falling apart, unquote. As a man, I tried to imagine being the patriarch of a house that looked like it was designed by a Quaker with attention deficit disorder, surrounded by 24 children, all of whom addressed me as the commander. At some point, I'm afraid I'd announce I was going out for a truckload of Pampers and just keep going. Or, more likely, Mom would. I gotta go.
The Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demeris. Special thanks to Kedar Lawrence, Joe Burke, and Arnie Warshaw.
Thanks also to Dan Brandon, Andy McDaniel, Merle Kessler, Angela Kilduff, and Corey Goldman.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strelovich. Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch are our directors of research. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Stanford Humanities Center, various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk,
and from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.